Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 93 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. I think when we look back on the Middle Ages, most of the time we're thinking about the human element. Peasants and tradespeople, monks and nuns, kings and queens. But if we want to get a clearer picture of the medieval world, we can't forget about the creatures that surrounded medieval people, from the horses they rode to the sheep they sheared. One of the most influential animals of the medieval world, both in the barnyard and on the table, was also one of the most troublesome, the pig. This week, I spoke with Dr. Jamie Kreiner about the role of the humble pig in the Middle Ages. Jamie is an associate professor of history at the University of Georgia, and in addition to being the author of The Social Life of Hagiography in the Merovingian Kingdom, she's also the author of one of my favorite books of 2020, Legions of Pigs in the Early Medieval West. Here's our conversation about why pigs were a legion in the medieval world and how they shaped everything from law to philosophy to theology. Well, thank you, Jamie, for joining me to talk about pigs. I'm super excited about this.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, writer to writer, I want to congratulate you because this ticks all the academic boxes. You know, the research is really good and stuff, but this is one of the most readable academic books I've ever read. You just have like a great sense of pace, and it's just really interesting the way you've laid everything out. So congratulations on a great book.
Wow, thanks.
Okay, so I don't want to make you blush. So let's just, we'll move on to pigs from here. So give us an idea of what pigs looked like in the Middle Ages. Did they look the same? Were they cute and pink? What did they look like?
To be honest, I'm not sure that many people today know what a lot of pigs today look like. Mm-hmm. I think we imagine the cartoonish fat pink one, but there's a lot of breeds now today too. In the early Middle Ages, they were usually smaller than the ones now by a lot. Like I'm 5'6". A tallish pig might have come up to my mid-thigh. And they were skinnier and really furry, tended to be brown, or at least that's how they were painted. It's kind of hard to know what colors they were based on the material evidence that survives, but they did come in other colors, if we could trust the manuscript paintings. And they were free-ranging, so they would have been more muscular, too.
Wow, I guess that would make better meat, I would think.
To be honest, I don't know. There's not a discussion in the medieval texts about whether stall-fed tastes better than free-range, and not actually eating pork myself now, I wouldn't even be able to guess.
I have to say, like, I'm not a vegan or a vegetarian or anything, but after you, like, talked through the way pigs think, I was considering, like, maybe I need to stop eating pigs, because they actually are kind of smart, ingenious little animals, aren't they? Big animals.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I try to do in the book is weigh the medieval evidence against what we know from modern mammal research about pigs, both factory farmed ones, but also free ranging and wild boar. It does seem like this is a kind of constant across the history of the species, is that they are really good at solving puzzles. They're very social. They problem solve. They have good memories. And they learn like people do. So the kinds of skills they develop are going to be historically and context specific. But it does seem like they were great at both being escape artists and also being very social.
Yeah. And this is going to cause all sorts of problems for medieval people, which I want to get into in a second. But first of all, where would we find pigs? Like, where would we find them in the Middle Ages?
You'd find them basically everywhere, except for probably Greenland, at least everywhere in the West, so the former Western half of the Roman Empire. The reason you don't find them in Greenland is because it's too cold there to raise livestock most of the year, or to graze them outside. So the advantage of pigs is that they will eat almost anything, but if you're using your own resources that you farm to feed them, it's not really a good deal anymore. Depending on where you were, there would have been more or less pigs, but they really were, you know, in Libya, North Africa, Iberian Peninsula, Gaul, Italy, Eastern Europe, the British Isles, Scandinavia, and they would have been underfoot a lot too. You wouldn't have seen them hidden. They would have often been very visible and around.
Yeah, I think we think of pigs today as being on farms, but that wasn't the case in the Middle Ages, was it?
Yeah, I mean, they would have been on farms, but they also would have ranged a lot. So there were areas in woods that were considered sort of extensions of farms. So especially in the fall after the nut crops fell, that's where you would find them for at least a month out of the year. They would have been taken to different kinds of fields or meadows, kind of ranged around in different places, close to the farm. And then sometimes it seems like some of them were stall fed. Sometimes you can tell that they were kept in a sty more often than not. And even in towns, some of them could have been kept, you know, just in a backyard. But often people would take the pigs out of town too to feed them for certain stretches of time.
Yeah, I don't think that we tend to think of pigs as being town animals, but they were town animals in the Middle Ages, and this caused all sorts of issues, right? I was speaking to Charles Spencer a couple of weeks ago about the White Ship disaster, and he was talking about how around the same time, the prince who was the heir to the throne in France was riding his horse through Paris, I think, and a pig ran out and his horse fell and the heir to the throne was killed. So what were some of the issues that happened in towns because of pigs?
Yeah, I mean, starting with more dense urbanization in the High Middle Ages, pigs get underfoot like they did for Prince Louis, but they also would, you know, kind of raid food sources that they weren't supposed to, like bakers or grocers. They would not only cause traffic problems, but also clog up waterways with their waste. It came to be such a problem that some towns outlawed pigs completely from being kept within the confines of the city, and others just issued really strict regulations on how to keep them basically under lockdown. But it was less of a problem in the early Middle Ages because towns were less densely populated and actually more agrarian than we'd expect. There was more farming happening in cities than in the High Middle Ages.
Right. And your book, just to be clear to everybody, your book deals with the earlier parts of the Middle Ages, right? So up to the year 1000. That's what it basically works on, although there is more to it than that. In fact, you actually get it, the New World at the end, which is really interesting stuff about pigs that I had no idea about, how the settlers of the quote-unquote New World brought pigs and caused all sorts of problems there too.
Yeah, and I think one of the most striking things about that process is that it's pretty clear that early settler colonists from, you know, say England would have known better. When they got to the New World, they just kind of let their pigs do whatever, knowing full well that they caused a lot of damage to other people's property. But because their neighbors were indigenous peoples, they don't seem to have cared almost at all. And I think knowing the medieval history of humans and their pigs make clear that this was a very, they would have known that this was an irresponsible thing to do.
Right, exactly, because pigs are always getting into other farmers' fields and stuff like that. So what were some of the laws and regulations around that? So like, say you found a pig in your field, what were you supposed to do with it?
First, you weren't supposed to kill it. And presumably those laws are on the books because people did, because they were furious. If pigs kept doing it, you were allowed to kill like one from the herd. Or maybe if a pig was in a really expensive, kind of easily damaged space like a vineyard, maybe you could take action sooner. But you also weren't supposed to injure the animals in any other way or injure their herder. I mean, it's clear that this caused a lot of real anger because pigs caused more damage than other kinds of livestock did because they are really good at rooting. And so instead of just sort of mowing down something that you've planted, they just completely uproot it. And also, it does seem that they got out more frequently than, say, cows or sheep or goats. I mean, technically, all of this was just supposed to be resolved by whoever owns the pig, pays a fine. That's all wrapped up. But it's clear that the farmers who found their property damaged thought this was totally inadequate. You only get a glimpse of this debate from the law codes, but it does seem like, you know, there are some people who think, just move on. It shouldn't be a problem. Animals, you know, you can't really help it. And other people seem to have thought, no, like, you should be making more of an effort to really anticipate what your animals are capable of doing and work with them a lot more closely in order to keep this kind of stuff from happening again. So there's a fight about what seems to be the most just way to resolve these conflicts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in the book is that pigs learn from each other, right? So if one pig jumps the fence, then the rest of them are going to follow it. And then it becomes a huge issue.
Yeah. Not only are they a problem because they learn so quickly from each other, and also because of their rooting. And again, for a third reason, they will eat anything almost. And they seem to have preferred stuff that was subterranean. So that, you know, puts them into destructive mode.
I like how there's a section in it where you're like, well, people got angry at pigs, but the Irish were nicer about it than everybody else. They were like, if the pig is terrified or if they're in heat, like you should just give the pig a break because it's not their fault.
Yeah, the Irish legal material is really amazing. And yeah, they seem to have thought of more mitigating circumstances than other lawmakers were interested in delineating. Yeah, that you really needed to understand a pig's mental state before you go around blaming them.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that in just a second, the pig's mental state, because that is actually a big part of the book too. But one of the things I think we should mention is that pigs are not just destructive to property, they could also be homicidal. And that is something that maybe we don't recognize as being a danger of the Middle Ages. You had to be careful of pigs. And one of the places I remember coming across this was in creating cradle design so that you would keep the pigs from like knocking a baby over or keep them from actually eating a baby in its cradle. So what were some of the dangers of pigs to people?
Yeah, I think we overlook this part of animals, in part because we assume domesticated livestock can't really do any damage, and in part just because most of us don't work with farm animals at all. And I think we kind of have this bad tendency now to assume animals are just like children rather than adult species of a different kind. So anyone that I've met today who's grown up at a farm knows immediately, oh yeah, pigs, you keep your distance from, and you don't want to be all cuddly with them, especially if you're a kid. I mean, they bite, and they're known to bite a lot, especially in the Middle Ages. There's a case from Ireland where, you know, a pig was locked up in a small enclosure with a calf, and the pig ended up killing the calf, presumably because it was hungry, but who knows what the fight was really about. They can kill adults, yes, children. In their search for food, they will dig up and eat human corpses. So there's a lot more respect for the kinds of things that pigs are capable of. And that's part of the reason that there was so much attention paid to figuring out how to deal with these animals.
Yeah, exactly. I think that when we think about pigs, like you say, they're cute and cuddly and pink and stuff. And when you think about them being an actual danger to people, it changes how you think about the relationship between humans and pigs. And one of the things that you mentioned is that humans are the ones domesticating the pigs, but pigs are also influencing how people are dealing with their environment and with their livestock and things like that. And one of the things that you say is that they were eaten enough that it seemed worth it to just like not throw out the whole idea. So tell us a little bit about the relationship between pigs being important enough to people's diet that they would actually go through the trouble of raising them.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. When you look at the laundry list of damages that they could cause, it's like, well, why don't you just give them up entirely? But one of the biggest assets was that pigs weren't just smart in ways that caused problems. They were smart and resourceful in ways that was really beneficial to humans. So because they could kind of transform any piece of the landscape into food, humans found that they were a great way to kind of hedge, or, you know, they were a resource that could help them diversify their investments on a farm. So humans in the Middle Ages didn't like eating acorns, but if pigs ate them, they'd convert them to bacon, basically. And then that was a great payoff, because often those acorns were free, or at least only required a small fee to have your pigs eat them. Pigs become a kind of co-worker where they're doing all of this work of converting the terrain into pork. And that really, it seems like a great trade-off for most people, despite all of the costs. Another asset with pork in particular is that it was treated as the best meat for curing. And so it was very rare to have a full-on barbecue in the early Middle Ages where you eat all that meat at once. Instead, they preferred to preserve it so it lasted a good part of the year, and you would use just little pieces of it in your cooking. And you could do that with beef too and other meats, but pork was seen to be the tastiest and the best one to do that. So both in terms of the labor that they provided and the quality of meat that resulted from it, it was seen to be, all right, let's try this kind of risky, expensive proposition, because it still seems like it's a net positive.
Yeah, well, it's true. When you think about it, nobody's making bacon out of beef, or if they are, I don't know about it, because I guess that combination of pork and salt, is there's something about it that people love.
I think, yeah, I mean, there was some beef curing, kind of like jerky, but yeah, it was sort of like not as good as the other options when it came to your livestock. The other thing that's really weird about pigs is that they're the only animal that's raised actually exclusively for their meat. Sometimes you do see farming communities raising some cattle just for meat consumption, or a mix of dairy and meat. But pigs are the only one that really, there's no other option. They don't produce other secondary products that people find particularly attractive or interesting or useful. So yeah, its meat better be good if that's really all that it's supposed to be providing.
Yeah, exactly. You can't make silk purses out of them, right? They're only for eating. But I'm thinking about how people picture the Middle Ages being really a dirty time and things like that. But I think that a pig would be pretty useful and closer to our modern time, or even in our modern time. They're eating things like slops and scraps and stuff, and maybe just taking care of business for the people on the farm.
Yeah, there's been really interesting studies where pigs in a modern context, like in the late 19th, early 20th century, when pigs get sort of forcibly removed from urban environments, particularly in poorer neighborhoods, the justification is often on the part of city governments, well, we need to clean up the space. But in fact, when you get rid of the pigs, they become dirtier spaces because no one's going around cleaning up trash. And if the city isn't providing trash pickup services for these poorer neighborhoods, suddenly they've just caused a problem rather than solving it.
Yeah, so it must have been a really fine balance to make it worth having these pigs in all spaces, farms and cities. Which makes me want to ask you the question, who was eating the pork at this time? So we know that lots of people loved it, loved bacon like they do now. Who was eating it in the Middle Ages?
A couple of groups seem to enjoy it in particular. Elites, people with more resources, tend to eat it in higher proportion than whatever's typical for where they live. In the late Roman Empire, it seems like some soldier settlements were eating more pork too. It does seem like Muslim settlements were not eating pork. You know, when we can tell that a settlement was populated by Muslims, there is a very low incidence of pork remains on site, unless there seem to have been Christians living in a particular neighborhood or area too. Occasionally, you do find the bones of wild boar on like an elite Muslim site. It seems like in some cases, the meat of wild boar was not considered categorically the same as domesticated pig. So it may have been interpreted as not haram in the same way as domesticated pork. But most Christian settlements in the early Middle Ages are eating at least some pork. The big determinant really is just what the mix of ecological options are. It's a little bit about class, but it's especially about what's available in the local farming area and landscape. So in the southern half of the Iberian Peninsula and in North Africa, you tend to not see a ton of pork, in part because it's a more arid environment and there's fewer woodlands for farming. But that's a huge generalization, and you'll find it varies a lot from place to place. So even a big statement like, oh, Italians tended to eat more pork than people in Gaul, you'll find a million exceptions to it, so it's almost not even worth generalizing like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the case with the entire Middle Ages, right? You have like 1,000 years and so much geography, and it's really hard to generalize as much as we try to do that. So, because pigs were kind of helpful in ways in which they were maybe helping people on the farms and things like that, would pigs be like pork be something that was more accessible to peasants perhaps than other meats?
Usually, actually, they're eating less pork than their sort of wealthier counterparts, in part because it seems like sometimes they had to pay pigs as a kind of land tax, and in part just because they didn't have the resources to spend a lot of time managing a kind of difficult animal, and they were likelier to eat the meat of animals that they were raising for other stuff. So once an ox kind of reached the end of its life for plowing, then you would eat it. Same for the sheep or goats you'd raise for dairy or for their wool or hides. So pork actually tends to be consumed less among people who don't have a ton of wealth. But yeah, again, you'll always find exceptions to that.
Yeah, absolutely. But that makes me think of the fact that it wasn't deer that were the main hunting animal at this time. It was wild boar. So can you tell us a little bit about the place of wild boar in the hunting tradition that's happening at this time?
Yeah, so it seems like almost everyone did some kind of hunting. One of the cool things about farming in the early Middle Ages is it's kind of a mix of agrarian agriculture and pastoralism, so raising animals, and also what we call like hunting or foraging in wilder spaces for berries, nuts, and then fish, birds, whatever. So a lot of people who were just regular farmers would have often hunted smaller game. Frogs, fish, turtles, birds. But if you were elite, if you had more time and resources, you would hunt big game. It does seem like occasionally farmers had hunted big game too, but it might have been more defensively than for recreation because the sport in the early Middle Ages was hunting. It was super masculine and elite and militaristic. It was seen as a great practice for warfare. So the hyped up animals, definitely boar stands at the top, although deer was also considered a prize. Bear, not so much. And then because pigs are dangerous, a lot of people died in boar accidents. I mean, it wasn't kind of this like overinflated sport where actually it wasn't that hard. It was a really challenging kind of hunt. So that's another reason that people who spent most of their time farming wouldn't have bothered. It's like, what's the point of going out to risk your life for something that could end very badly?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think having read stuff about this before, it's the tusks of the wild boar are really dangerous to people, especially because they're at the right height to take out your major arteries in your legs, right?
Yeah, apparently to kill a wild boar in this time, you have to go in close for the final kill. Like, you can't just kill it from a distance in the way you could with, say, a deer. And in any case, a deer would be somewhat less dangerous. So yeah, that kind of like intimate, close-up, final part of the battle is the most dangerous. So you see, as a result, this kind of hunt celebrated all over elite imagery, especially earlier on when there's a lot of mosaics still that elites are installing in their villas and their receiving rooms, really playing up how important the hunt is to their identity.
Yeah. And when you're mentioning the artwork that features wild boars, I'm thinking of it and they're always so angry, those boars. Their eyebrows are always like way down. They are fierce looking creatures. They don't look like a cuddly pig for sure.
Yeah, it's true. The wild, that it may be some of the best stuff in early medieval iconography, just the intensity of it. And sometimes it's played up for this to emphasize the machismo of the hunt. And then sometimes you see it, like when the wild boar appears in illuminations with the Old Testament, it's kind of epitomizing evil. So you can play it up for that reason too.
That's true. That's true. And you talked about, well, the book is called Legions of Pigs. Why did you call it Legions of Pigs?
It's kind of a riff on a story in the Synoptic Gospels where Jesus cures a possessed man or men. And in a couple of the accounts, when the demons leave the possessed person or persons, they say, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And then they ask Jesus permission if he could send them into a herd of pigs. And he does. And when they enter the pigs careen off a cliff into the sea. And there's a lot of, especially toward the end of the period that I look at, so toward the year 1000, there's a lot of really cool exploration of this story in art in particular. But I also just liked the idea that pigs were kind of everywhere. They were legion. They were trouble. And the story wouldn't have made sense to readers in antiquity if it was a different kind of animal. Like, it would have been much more comical and weird if the demons had been like, "Send us into a bunch of chickens." So there's something kind of, there's an important link between demons wanting to go into a problematic animal that are so unruly.
Yeah, they're already ready for it. Yeah, it wouldn't be different if it was bunnies or something.
Yeah, that would be, Monty Python should have done something like that, recreating the demon scene with bunnies.
Actually, well, speaking of art, there's always evil bunnies as well. But that is off the beaten track for our podcast today. But you were talking about the mental state of pigs. And like I said, there's quite a lot in the book that talks about pigs as being kind of a way to understand the world, both in kind of small terms and in big terms. So how are people thinking about pigs in terms of like religion and philosophy at this time? How is this a window for understanding the cosmos?
Well, there's a couple different strands. One, which theologians had just internalized really fundamentally, was that all the little stuff in the world, because it had been created by God as part of some larger blueprint for how the divine order should be, it offered a kind of key or connection to understanding that bigger picture. So if you really delved down into the specifics of gnats or tidal currents or stellar rotations, it would help you unlock other parts of that architecture. So pigs are one among many potential windows into understanding better how God put stuff together and why. And another way that people were thinking about pigs in this period was it helped them sort of pivot around some crucial ideas in Christian theology that pigs just kind of helped them puzzle through or solve. So they seemed to represent the kind of splitness of the material world of matter, pigs were treated as metonymies for flesh, really. Like, because they were the animal that were raised for meat, their meatiness came to stand for all the things that were good and bad about meat and matter. So it was both an obstruction to spiritual progress, but it was also the medium for progress and the medium for salvation. And so they started thinking more and more about pigs as being both a kind of consummately sinful symbol. Legions of pigs also, or the legion that entered pigs, helped to accelerate that kind of trajectory. But it was also a really kind of sacrificial symbol that pigs, you know, it was very clear. They only lived a couple of years before they were slaughtered. They were raised exclusively to be slaughtered. And people came to think, you know, they're giving life to extend human life in a similar way to the way that Jesus' own body was offered as a kind of means to extend humanity's lives for eternity. So yeah, they kind of came to absorb all these really paradoxical ways of thinking about flesh.
Yeah. And when you see medieval philosophy, it's such a sophisticated thing where you see layers upon layers of how they're thinking about it. And one of the things that you mentioned is that in order to do this, you actually have to think like a pig to understand them. And this was something that people actively did, was to try and take the perspective of animals as well as people in order to understand the world a bit better, right?
Yeah, that was one of the coolest things to learn, is that I don't know why there's this sort of idea that that sort of perspective is strictly postmodern. It was so also early medieval. They realized that, you know, humans have a particular vantage on the world that's inescapably limited and partial. And there are other kinds of ways of seeing the world that other animals possessed. So, you know, they knew eagles could see really well. They knew sheep could smell really well. When you notice that a mother sheep is always able to find her lamb in a huge flock, they realized that her whole ways of perceiving the barnyard were different than her caretaker's was. And so just their very willingness and capacity to see that knowledge is really conditioned by the particular vantage point that you occupy. And how cool would it be if you could learn more about the universe by trying to shift that vantage point and at least start to imagine how it might seem to other creatures. It's a really impressive and sophisticated move on their part.
Yeah. And like you say, it's not something that is exclusive to us. It was really important. And I think that, you know, the person who has to understand the pigs best is a swineherd. And for them to understand pigs well enough, they really have to put themselves in their hooves, I guess.
I know. I think of all of the things that I researched for the book, this is the one where I'd kill the most to have more documentation for. There's definitely glimpses of the kinds of knowledge that swineherds needed to have and the kinds of things they tried to learn. But oh man, it would be amazing to have, you know, like a manual or just like some notes that they were writing to each other. You know, of course, that's just like completely unrealistic. We don't start getting manual literature for several hundred more years at least. But yeah, that kind of tacit knowledge, oh, it would be so priceless to find.
The Diary of a Swineherd. Yeah, that would be really good. Well, I'm trying to think, like, how many pigs would a swineherd be in charge of if that was their full profession?
I don't know. I would guess maybe 40 to 80. It could have been more. We only get a few kind of figures, but that seems to have been about what a swineherd and maybe an assistant or two would have managed. Add more assistants, add more pigs. They'd also have a dog. Dogs have all sorts of specializations in the early Middle Ages, and one of them was to work with pigs. And other farms that were smaller, maybe it was just, you know, a single household or a homestead. Maybe they managed to kind of keep one eye on pigs while doing other things. It would be better if you and other farms could pool your pigs and kind of have one person watching them. But it does seem that even if you did have a swineherd watching pigs, you weren't going to prevent the kinds of damages that we had talked about earlier.
Yeah, 40 to 80 pigs, you'd really have to stay a step ahead of them if they were all together at once. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and they're not as easy to herd as sheep or goats or cattle. They run off. It was sort of anticipated in the late Roman period, when more pig herding was happening on a larger scale, that you could lose maybe 10% of your pigs in a longer trek. that probably wasn't really happening much in the early Middle Ages, but it just points to the fact that, yeah, I mean, you're dealing with that many animals who aren't that interested in following you all of the time. It's a really tough job.
I was thinking about how, you know, they're transported to the New World and stuff. And I'm thinking about them being transported all over the medieval world. That would have been a big task to try and keep your pigs occupied on a ship, I think, for weeks at a time.
Oh my God. Yeah, I can't even imagine. They're definitely one of the most striking things in the Middle Ages is that they seem to have been the most localized of the livestock. That it was very unlikely that you'd move them long distances, which sometimes seems to have been the case for cattle. Occasionally, it seems like people were herding them long distances from Eastern to Western Europe. And then definitely, of course, for goats and sheep, transhuman pastoralism was pretty standard. But you don't see people opting into those kinds of systems for pigs very much, in part because you don't need to move to higher ground in a different season to feed them. They'll just eat whatever.
I just trying to picture moving a pig that doesn't want to go somewhere. It would be really, really difficult. Whereas, you know, with a goat, you could probably manage it.
You know, I've watched videos where, you know, people experiment with leading pigs in different ways now. And, you know, they figured out pretty interesting techniques for it. But in some ways, you kind of have to be paying attention to individuals. And when you've got 40 or 80 individuals, yeah, it's going to be harder.
You have to figure out who is friends with who in the pig herd and who you can get to follow someone else. And wow.
Yeah, there's a really fun miracle story from the 9th century where a herder, his pigs kind of run off into a place that he's never seen before. He has no idea how to get home or how he's going to lead all those pigs back because, again, it's not familiar terrain. And a saint appears to him and tells him, "This is the sow that is going to lead all your pigs home for you. Just give her a good smack. She'll start off and everything else will fall into place." And it works, you know, because it's a miracle story. But I kind of love that there's a leader, which is common in wild pig herds today. There's a female leader, and this was a female leader back then. And yeah, it does seem like you need to understand their hierarchies in order to get them moving. But again, I'd love to know more of the little tricks and challenges that they confronted as herders.
Yeah. I love those miracle stories that are really down on the ground, the everyday stuff that they deal with. Like St. Bridget, doesn't she have a miracle with bacon as well?
Yeah. And there's a miracle where she is really bad at herding pigs. Like it seems like her dad assigned her to the job for a day and she kind of screwed it up. Because like, yes, that's what happens when you have a young girl assigned to a really difficult job that an adult should take on.
Yeah, exactly. In her defense, that's the toughest job on the farm.
Yeah. I mean, God solves things for her, but yes, her dad should have known better.
I love that. Okay, so I need to ask you before we wrap up, was there anything that surprised you or was kind of like the thing that you want to share most with people about pigs? Because I don't know if we've covered that. So this is such an interesting book on such an interesting topic. Is there something that you feel like you need to tell the world about medieval pigs?
I think it's a great example of how we've lost a lot of knowledge. We're not always learning more and more and more. We often forget things too. And the things that people knew from having and choosing to pay a lot of attention to their pigs, it changed their minds about a lot. So pigs end up becoming a formative participant in early medieval culture, not just in this kind of instrumental way where they're just like a symbol and a springboard for thinking about stuff that has nothing to do with them, but really people changed their minds because of these intimate working relationships that they developed with their animals. And I thought that was really cool.
I think it is really cool. And I think it really comes across in the book. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast to tell us all about pigs. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
To find out more about Jamie's work, you can visit her page at the University of Georgia at history.uga.edu/directory/people/Jamie-Kreiner. Her fun and fascinating book is Legions of Pigs in the Early Medieval West. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. So there's some really fascinating news about when, where, and how the Black Death first came into Europe. This month, the journal Speculum has an article by Hannah Barker. And first of all, she basically discredits the story that we've always heard, that you can read in every textbook, that it was the Mongols were besieging a port called Kaffa in the Black Sea, and they catapulted a whole bunch of dead bodies into the city, and they that caused the people in the city to get plague, and then they sailed off to Europe, and everyone caught it there. So she really discredits that story. I won't give you too many details, but it involves lots of grain, trade embargoes, and another city entirely in the Black Sea where it kind of comes from. So we have some news on that. It's really kind of a fascinating article. So we have our kind of summary for that on medievalist.net.
Oh, man, I'm so looking forward to reading that, because that is a classic story, like you say, like everybody knows that one. And I really can't wait to hear what the evidence is to change the story.
Yeah. So we have got that. We've got a bunch of other news. And we also take a look at The Green Knight at the movies.
Oh, is that coming out soon?
There is a new version coming out. Yeah, of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. But apparently The Green Knight has come in a few more times before in the films and on TV. So, or Murray Dahm gives us a kind of a background into all these other kind of depictions.
Ooh, that sounds good. I love that story.
Me too.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Peter. That sounds like a good roundup for this week.
Thanks.
A big shout out, as usual, goes to our patrons on patreon.com for just being so completely awesome every month. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast get access to all sorts of goodies, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our original maps by Tina Ross. And this month, you get the chance to vote on the theme of an article I'm going to write just for patrons. To find out more about that and how to become a patron, visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from pigs to plague, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an epic day.